You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
And I'm Jonathan Capehart, sitting in today for Leonard Lopate. In his latest book, In Vino Duplicitas, The Rise and Fall of a Wine Forger Extraordinaire, Peter Hellman looks at how Rudy Kernioan, a young stranger to the rarefied world of high-end wine collecting, started to counterfeit expensive rare wines and built many of the world's richest, savviest collectors out of hundreds of millions of dollars. Mr. Hellman was present at the 2008 auction where suspicions were first raised about the authenticity of Mr. Kernioan's wines, and he followed the story through Mr. Kernioan's 2012 conviction on federal fraud charges. Peter Hellman is a journalist whose work has appeared in Wine Spectator, The New York Times, The Wall Street Journal, New York Magazine, and other publications. This is his eighth book, and it's published by The Experiment, and I am pleased that it brings Peter Hellman to the show. Thank you very much for being here.
Pleasure, Jonathan.
Of course, like I said, I was going to mess up Mr. Kernioan's name, but you've been following this story since the very beginning in real time. And I mentioned it in your introduction, but this is an incredible story. Did you know it was an incredible story when you went to that auction here in Manhattan?
You know, you would know as a journalist, or as a freelance, I tend to do one-offs. I go from one story to the next. They often have nothing to do with each other. In this case, I was pretty sure when I went to this auction at a now defunct restaurant called Crew on April 25th, 2008, that this would be a one-off story. It seemed like nothing much, but as you say, for 8 years I followed it until Rudy Kernioan became the first person ever sentenced to prison time in the federal court system.
And you've described him, you called him a masterful, mysterious, and gentle-natured Indonesian of Chinese ethnicity who stood out at wine tastings and auctions. When did he begin showing up? How does someone like Rudy Kernioan just magically appear in the rarefied air of upper echelon wine collectors in Manhattan?
Well, that puts him in the class of, I think, almost all real great con men. Nobody's quite sure. He appears to have come to the U.S. to go to college in California in the mid-90s. He did not much of anything. He worked in a golf pro shop part-time. He did a little accounting. He did nothing. And then suddenly, in about 2001, 2002, he just vaults into the scene, onto the scene, as a guy with loads of money who could buy the most expensive wines. I'm not talking about wines in the hundreds of dollars. I'm talking about wines in the thousands of dollars, which he poured generously and liberally. That's another sign of a good con man. Be generous. And he went from being a nobody to hobnobbing with very wealthy people, not just millionaires, but billionaires, corporate titans, all because he poured generously very expensive wines. And that's where it got him. But it's all mysterious in the end.
So did he already know a lot about rare wines when he first started attending all these things?
Rudy Kernioan claims that he went to a birthday dinner for his father on Fisherman's Wharf in San Francisco in 2000 or possibly 1999. He ordered an expensive bottle of wine, Opus One, California wine. It knocked him back. It was his epiphany. And at that moment, really, or from that time on, he began to incessantly buy expensive wines, open them at home in Arcadia, California, where he lived with his mother, day and night, opening wines, kind of gearing up his taste abilities. And it turned out that he had extraordinary abilities to not only taste wines, but remember the wines and discriminate between different wines.
So he had an ability, apparently during a blind taste test, he was able to identify 10 out of 12 wines correctly?
He did do that often. And in fact, one taster who saw him do this at restaurants in Los Angeles said, "I'm going to fix Rudy. I'm going to do a tasting at my house because I think he's cheating. He's paying $1,000 or something to somebody in the kitchen to tip him off which wine is which." So this gentleman set up a tasting in his own dining room, which he controlled completely, put 12 wines on the table for Rudy to taste blind. There was no way he could know which was which, and Rudy got 10 out of 12. He repeated it again and again, and each time Rudy got 10 out of 12 and really got very close on the other two.
Now, where did his money come from? Because didn't he act like he was independently wealthy? And as you said, he's, pouring very liberally, pouring very expensive wines out for people to have.
Well, the backup to that is he was spending at least $1 million a month, sometimes $1 million a week.
Holy smokes.
On purchasing wine in the U.S. and the U.K. and Europe. So he was apparently able to spend unlimited amounts of money. Where did that money come from? That's not a pretty picture there, and it's mysterious. Nobody has ever identified it. Rudy Kernighan said that his money came from his family, which owned the beer franchise for Heineken beers in Asia, certainly in Indonesia. But one of the four Koch brothers, Bill Koch, sent investigators to Indonesia and to China to try to figure out whether any of this was true. None of it was true.
And Koch was one of two people who went after Rudy Kernighan because they felt he was a fraud.
You know, it's interesting, Jonathan. Most of the billionaires who he sold wine to were ashamed when they learned that they had been hoodwinked. Bill Koch is a different species of fish, so to speak. He wasn't ashamed to say he had been hoodwinked. He was willing to spend millions and millions and millions of dollars to find out all he could about Rudy Kernighan. And what he found out was everything Rudy said was a lie.
I'm Jonathan Capehart, sitting in today for Leonard Lopate, and I'm speaking with Peter Hellman about his latest book, In Vino Duplicitas, The Rise and Fall of a Wine Forger Extraordinaire, that wine forger's name, Rudy Kernighan. Okay, we got to talk about the actual fraud here. So was he was opening all these bottles of wine. Was he then pouring other wine into actual bottles of old vintages?
You're on the right track.
Okay.
His emails showed that he would buy very old commercial grade French Burgundies and Bordeaux wines in Europe. These were things that were lying around in cellars forgotten for decades. They were not meant for collecting, for keeping, for long, but they were old, and they were in old bottles, hand-blown bottles, not machine-molded bottles. And they had kind of the look of age to them. He would buy these wines, have them sent to his house in Arcadia, California. And then if he wanted to reproduce, say, a 1959 Burgundy wine, he would pour out half of a bottle of 1959 commercial-grade Burgundy, never meant to be kept this long. And then he would pour in a certain portion of a very good quality California Pinot Noir, same grape, and he would mix and match until he got what was a wine which, if you were a collector and you paid a lot of money for it and you opened it, you would say, wow, this has the funk of old Burgundy, but it also has this wonderful youthful fruit. It's amazing. After 70 years, this wine is still cranking. And he was able to do that because his taste buds were extremely good when it came to wine tasting.
Does everyone who buys bottles at these auctions, do they always taste, try them, open them immediately after buying them? Or is this the sort of thing that you buy it, you put it in your cellar, and then maybe one day you'll actually drink it?
Well, interesting you should ask that, because one of Rudy's techniques was that before big auctions of his wine, he would host dinners, pre-auction dinners, at which he would open wines which were going to be sold the next day. Those wines were probably real. But when you say, wow, love this 59 Clos Saint-Denis, you're ready to buy it for $60,000 a case the next day, that wine would be counterfeit.
And so how did Rudy get tripped up?
How he got tripped up is really an arcane little nothing of a story. He tried at this Acker auction I mentioned at Crewe in April 08. He offered 22 lots of wine from a very sought-after Burgundian domain, Domaine Ponceau, and included 7 lots of a wine called Clos Saint-Denis, one of the 32 top wines of Burgundy. And he offered them in vintages 1945 through 71, Clos Saint-Denis from Domaine Ponceau. He neglected to notice that this particular domain never made wine from Clos Saint-Denis until 1982, because the current fourth-generation proprietor's father only got access to Clos Saint-Denis in 1982. So this was an open-and-shut case, the rare one, where the wine could not exist because Domaine Ponceau couldn't make it.
So in the end, what ended up happening to Rudy Cunillon? Tried, convicted?
He was, and that was only because the federal government, the federal prosecutors, have better things to do normally than go after wine counterfeiters. They've got terrorism, they've got drugs, they've got Wall Street shenanigans. In this case, a young assistant U.S. attorney, Jason Hernandez, combined with a crusty FBI agent in charge of the art fraud squad, and the two of them together laboriously went through the emails to try to figure out what happened, because they didn't know if Rudy was simply buying fake wine and unknowingly passing it on to other buyers, or was he the person who was actually making the wine? And it took them a while, but they figured it out.
I mean, he was tried, convicted, and sentenced to 10 years in prison in 2013. So does that make him the first person and only person ever to be convicted in federal court for the crime of selling counterfeit wine?
That is correct.
I sort of chuckle because, as you said, with all the things happening in the world, I can only imagine what that crusty old detective from the art fraud squad must have been thinking, you know, trying to investigate a crime in an extremely rarefied world.
Yes, and if I could say, Jonathan, you know, wine, old wine, most of the things that we eat or we sip, we want to be fresh. We want our egg in the morning to be fresh from the farm. It's only wine that reaches the age of 50, 60, or even 100 years in certain cases where we'll pay the most for it because it's reaching its best moment to appreciate. There's nothing else like wine. And if you can find that 50 or 60 or 100-year-old wine and you have the money to park into it, you're glad to do it.
Did many people think 10 years was a long sentence for Rudy Cunillon?
I think people did feel that. And here it's unusual. And you asked earlier about where all this money came from, $40 million to buy wine. Rudy, by the way, had 28 million American Express membership miles when he was arrested.
28 million?
Yeah.
Holy
but he couldn't use them because he was an illegal alien at this point. So it was a shame. But yeah, a lot of people thought it was too long a sentence. He could have had a plea bargain and had a much shorter sentence. Why he didn't do that, I think, was to protect the secret of where that money came from. And you got to read the book, In Vino Veritas, excuse me, In Vino Duplicitas. Made my own bad mistake, sorry.
I mean, I wonder, do you think that the reason why people thought that 10 years was too much is because they don't believe that this is a crime?
I think so, and his lawyer argued that, you know, if you hoodwink the average Joe out of a couple of $1,000, that can hurt that person. But he was hoodwinking billionaires, literally, like Bill Koch, who could spend $25 million on investigating these wine counterfeiters. So the idea was, well, if they couldn't find an expert to check out the wine before they bid on it, and they were spending up to $60,000 a case for wow. wine. And I would just quickly say that the period that Rudy was operating, about 2003 to 2008, was the time of bundled subprime mortgages.
Yes.
It was the time when 23-year-olds could go to work in Wall Street and without doing anything as socially useful as slinging French fries at McDonald's, could make hundreds of thousands and millions of dollars just by clicking on stuff. And so there was a lot of surplus money around, a lot of young people who just said, okay, I made $1 million this year, so I'll spend $30,000 on wine.
This is a great story, and folks, you should pick this up. This is a very interesting story. I'm Jonathan Capehart, and today for Leonard Lopate, I've been speaking with Peter Hellman about his latest book, In Vino Duplicitas, The Rise and Fall of a Wine Forger Extraordinaire. Peter, thank you so much for being here.
Love being here.